I call to order the House Committee on Human Services on today's date, January 23rd, 2009. And we're opening up an informational meeting about senior services overview. Representative Cowan, who has been chair of a subcommittee looking at these issues throughout the interim.
Good morning, Madam Chair and fellow members of my committee. Feels a little different from down here. For the record, my name is Jean Cowan. And what I'd like to do this morning is sort of try to bring everybody to the same point in time in a discussion of community-based long-term care for seniors and people with physical disabilities. I know that that's a lot of words, but they're all very important pieces of the subject that we're talking about. And the presenters that follow me are going to flesh out the detail. I'd just like to give you a bit of an overview of what we've been doing and why we're here. There are several things that brought me personally to this particular issue. One is that I believe very strongly in budgeting in a manner that we try to provide a level of service that will be the most cost-effective and the least costly in the long run. That's kind of been a guiding premise all of my years of public service. Secondly, that I think that we very sincerely owe respect and dignity to our aging and most vulnerable members of our community at a point in time when they might need some assistance. Thirdly, I have some personal experience in this arena. I took care of six of my elderly family members, managed their care through the end of their lives, and I've seen quite a bit of different variety in the spectrum of that. And that brings me to the 2000 legislative session. In February, in the middle of my freshman year, trying to figure out how this whole thing operates, I was informed that one of the assisted living facilities in my district, the corporate management had made the determination that they were going to do an immediate 60-day withdrawal from Medicaid care, and that 15 of my constituents would find themselves out of a home. That was not a pretty process to go through. These individuals lived in this group setting with others, and nobody really knew where the check came from that paid their care. And so they were all friends. And suddenly you have two groups of people, Medicaid people and other people. We did manage to relocate those folks. But it made me realize at the end of the session that we had to step back and take a look at our system and see what we could do to help make a better process. And a number of folks had come to me with ideas through the session, and they all wanted support on everything, and I found that when the legislature gets confused, the answer is no. So we sat down and said, you know what, we need to have a discussion about how we're going to do this. We need to bring it together in a more comprehensive and collaborative manner and make some agreements so that we have a direction and a vision. That led to the chair of the subcommittee on seniors that Chair Tomei mentioned, and really a lot of work on what the system looks like. Oregon does have an exemplary long-term care system. It was conceived decades ago, and the system's pioneers recorded their vision in ORS 410. When I travel to other states and look at systems, I am reminded of how much we should respect, care about, and hang on to Oregon's system. Numbers vary a little bit, but the loose numbers are that in Oregon, about 70% of our Medicaid-eligible individuals can be cared for in in-home care or what I call mid-level care facilities, residential care, assisted living, and adult foster care, and only about 30% find it necessary to be admitted to nursing home-level, skilled nursing-level care. Those percentages are almost exactly the opposite in the majority of other states. 70% of individuals in other states who are Medicaid eligible end up in nursing homes. I found that really sort of fascinating. I've kind of tested it when I've talked to a few groups, and they just look at me like I'm crazy to think that an individual on Medicaid might actually get to live in an assisted living facility. So I think we need to remember to be proud of what we've got as we look at where we can go in the future. We gathered together the key stakeholders and went to work. And I probably don't have to tell any of this group that the statistics are really staggering when we look at the number of individuals who will be entering eligibility in our senior care services arena. Now, I'm pretty happy to think that not everybody who turns 65 automatically needs a whole bunch of help, because I'm not quite ready to take that, thank you. But as people progress through the aging process and reach their 80s, oftentimes needs do develop. Then we look at some combined years of disinvestment in the system's foundation, and it's sort of transferred to kind of a crumbling underlying support base, and that's at the same time as the system's demands are taking a sharp upward climb. So really the ultimate cost for us of doing nothing is frightening, because nursing home admission is an entitlement if one is eligible for Medicaid. And if that's the state's only option, is to admit individuals in need to nursing homes, it's going to break our budget, plain and simple. And that's why we need to look at the rest of our system. I wasn't the first one to think of this, and when we get the overview from the Department of Human Services, I'm sure we'll go back into some of the other earlier budget notes and discussions that we had. But where I sort of picked it up was after the 07 session, and working with the coalition, the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities, we had really tremendous stakeholder participation. We worked jointly with the Senate Committee on Seniors, and that resulted in the development of Senate Bill 1061 that was part of the 2008 session. I'm not sure if it is available to you at your desk today, but the legislation focused basically on two intents. One was to just sort of codify the direction for a comprehensive plan that needed to be developed. And I'm sure that plan will be made available to you today. It was completed in September of 08, and it talks a little bit about the history of our system and how we got to where we are and what the needs are. And then the second section of Senate Bill 1061 asked for a report on cost projections for the key components of some of the, I call it the laundry list of ideas that this group of stakeholders has sort of pulled together and said, these are the things that we need to do. And it's quite inclusive. Runs through volunteer programs. It runs through our vaulted Oregon Project Independence and a whole variety of other things that we could do to stabilize the system. We brought also.
And if I'm wondering if maybe we shouldn't save this part of the discussion until we're.
I'm going to skip over it pretty quickly.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. We also brought to the 08 session discussion around the Department of Human Services rebalance. And what's important about that to remember is simply that we managed to put some additional money into Medicaid rates. And the reason for that was to try to forestall the kind of activity that I'd experienced at Spencer House in Lincoln County, in terms of lessening the disparity between the private pay rates and the public pay rates in those mid-level facilities. And that rate increase of $260 a month was very much welcomed by the assisted living and adult foster care community. So that cooperative effort has continued as we looked for a plan for 2008. We knew that we needed to continue to fix and reinvest in Oregon's long-term care system in a cost avoidance methodology. All that reasoning sounded really good. The goals were commendable. And when we kind of got done with the list, the costs were about $140 million for our initial plan. I have the list here, and it's great. Unfortunately, it had to take a back burner as the budget challenges have developed. Subsequently, with the release of the governor's recommended budget and looking at what some of the impacts might do to the system, there are a number of folks here today that need to speak to the overall senior and people with disabilities care system. And I'm going to turn it over to them to give you the particulars of their particular interest areas. But then hopefully I'll be able to bring it back at the end with just a little note of optimism, because we do have some thoughts on a specific bill that we may be able to move forward that might give us the opportunity for some first steps in some positive direction, even at the same time as we try our best to fill the budget holes and to not make cuts that will ultimately be hugely damaging to individuals and also far more costly to the state of Oregon in the long run. So at this point in time, I would like to bring up James Taves to give you the departmental view, and then we'll listen to the others. And I will join you so I can hear what's being said.
Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Collin. Colleagues, our intent today is to give us all an overview about the situation in Oregon regarding care for seniors. And it's a huge issue. This bill that we're going to be talking about, we know that it's not ready to start any kind of movement. We're just going to get a first view of it. There will be some changes. There will be lots more input. But we wanted early on to start looking at these issues because they are so vitally important to the state and to a large group of people. So this is just the beginning of a dialogue. James, thanks for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, the Senior and Disabilities Program. What I'd like to do today is just give a brief overview, and then that will be fully amplified by all the stakeholders that have worked very hard with us over the past, actually the past 4 years in all of these planning efforts. But to set the stage, we included in your packets a set of charts that I want to show you real quickly, because it sets the stage for our long-range planning process and where we're at right now with Oregon's long-term care system. And looking at these charts, the first one simply describes over an 8-year period the trends in all of our service settings. You'll note again that, and if you went back even earlier into the 80s and the 90s, you'd see a much more precipitous decline in the use of nursing facilities. But these are the trend lines in our entire service system over recent years, with again some concerns about declining capacity in part of our assisted living and community-based care system, including some major decline in our in-home program that really occurred after 2003 in that recession, where we cut people at lower impairment levels who for the most part benefited from the in-home program, and so we actually lost several thousand individuals, and that's why you see that decline around 2003. So those are the trends. The next page is what Representative Callen was really talking about, and this is kind of the miracle of Oregon. Where people are served, a little over 10,000 in community-based care, a little over 10,000 in in-home programs, and a little over 5,000 in nursing facilities. And again, there's only 5 states in the country that actually, in their expenditures, expend more for community-based care than nursing home care. Only 5 states, which is absolutely incredible. And most states still expend 60, 70, 80% of their entire long-term care budget on the institutional side as opposed to the community side. So this is the hallmark of Oregon's system.
Could you hold up, James? I think I have a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, can we just have a definition for those of us kind of new to this on community-based facility?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, community-based facilities are basically 3 types: adult foster care, assisted living, and other residential care facilities, and with a whole series of specializations there for Alzheimer units and things like that. But they are, that's the 3 basic components of our community-based care system, and then a very large in-home program, which also is obviously community care, but they're not facility-based.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent question, and please do feel free to ask questions. Yes.
Sure.
Suzanne, did you have another question?
He read my mind.
Okay. Yes, Representative Mao.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. James, on this chart, in the conversation we have with fellow legislators, because we hear the message here in this committee, is this chart is great, and I know there's some money, there's a money chart later, but it's to take these same definitions and say, in a different chart, how much of that, of the pie, does nursing home take up of 100%? So that a dollar, so you can have it side by side, that would be really helpful in a very simple conversation.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, actually, we have an overlay. I didn't bring that with me, and that is real illustrative. I think about 40% or a little over 35% of our budget is on the nursing home side, and then, but we can break that down and provide a simple overlay that demonstrates that, exactly what you're asking.
Okay, thank you.
Just elaborate on that, please, especially for the new members. How much, for instance, the nursing, the in-home care costs and the community care costs? Give a brief example of how much that might be if people are in the Oregon Health Plan, as opposed to a nursing.
Madam Chair, on the long-term care side, excluding the Oregon Health Plan and acute care costs, nursing home rates now are a little over $6,000 a month per person. In-home care is a little over $10 an hour, plus we also pay for health benefits and workers' compensation for home care workers. So depending on the number of hours that clients have, that's about the hourly rate. Community-based care in terms of foster care, residential care, assisted living ranges between $1,200 and $2,200. So in most cases, nursing home are two or three times the cost of what typically is the rest of our community-based care system.
Great. I think that's the point we wanted to get across here. Thank you.
The next chart, Madam Chair, is a chart that demonstrates by functioning level where all of the people in long-term care are situated or where they're served. And we can go in more detail later, but the SPL at the left hand, those are service priority levels. In Oregon, we assess every senior and person with a physical disability for what their needs for assistance are in activities of daily living. So that includes dressing, toileting, eating, mobility, all of those. And we actually do an electronic assessment with the highest impairment level being level 1, the least impaired level being level 13. And you can see at level 3, for example, which is near total care, it's people that require major assistance in all of their activities of daily living. That, again, is sort of the miracle of the Oregon system, because you can see people at that functioning level are served in many different settings, not just in institutional care. And then finally, just a chart that shows the breakdown of people in long-term care over age 65 and under age 65 by county. We don't have it broken down by each of your districts, but you can kind of see the number of people that we serve in each area of the state. So that's where Oregon's long-term care system is right now in terms of the numbers. And again, Oregon still ranks at nearly the top of the country in most of those areas. We've been involved in a long-range planning process, and I want to sort of describe that at a high summary level and then get in more detail as the stakeholders come up. We've been involved in a long-range planning effort for about 4 years now. It was initiated by the governor in 2005. We had a large stakeholder group, many subcommittees, many public hearings around the state that culminated in an initial report in 2006. We then brought that to the 2007 legislature, which set further goals in that planning process. We had a lengthy budget note from the Ways and Means Committee in the 2007 session directing us to continue that planning process. And then Representative Callan referenced Senate Bill 1061 during the supplemental February session that also laid out the areas that we need to do further planning, plus bring a series of pretty discrete cost assumptions and potential budget packages to implement many of those recommendations. The reasons for the long-range planning are pretty obvious, but they're twofold. One, obviously, is the aging demographic. Nationally, the numbers of people over age 65 will go from a little over 40 million to nearly 80 million over the next 20 years. In Oregon, likewise, we'll go from about 400,000 to close to 800,000 people over age 65. It was very interesting. The Social Security Administration last year issued a big press release because on January 1st of 2008, the very first baby boomer from New Jersey, her name is Miss Casey Kirschling, filed for Social Security online. She was born a second after January 1st, 1946. So the first boomer entered the Social Security system as of last year, and of course that wave now is gonna accelerate very quickly over the coming years. A lot of alarm signals are going off nationwide about this demographic trend. Many states, like Oregon, are grappling with how we need to position ourselves. And when you begin to look at just the financing at a national level and then start to boil that down to a state level, the United States Comptroller General, before he retired last year, David Walker, basically took the entire aging demographic, he loaded it on just Medicaid and Medicare, excluding Social Security, and shows that by 2045, most of the federal budget would have to go to pay for Medicaid and Medicare to accommodate that large aging demographic. And that even excludes Social Security. So we have to be very thoughtful about that in terms of the huge debt load we're already accumulating in this country, and then this demographic wave will come on the top of that. In your packet is the comprehensive plan draft, and I just want to reference a couple further charts and graphs in here to kind of set the stage for this planning effort. On page 4 and page 5 are just the charts and graphs that show the aging demographic over the next 20 years, with the largest cohort that's growing are people over age 65, between age 65 and 74. But also, if you look on page 5, the blue line, which is people over age 85, that doesn't look so dramatic, but in terms of the implication on long-term care, it's very dramatic. Generally, it's thought that between ages 65 and 74, your chances of needing some assistance with daily living activities is about 1 in 4. Between 74 and 85, it's about 2 in 4. And then over age 85, it's 3 in 4 or 4 in 4. It's almost 100%. So that subgroup that is growing very rapidly means that the demand on long-term care will accelerate very quickly. On page 7, we simply extrapolated and projected forward what we think the Medicaid caseload, and that's the number of seniors and people with disabilities that will actually require public assistance for their long-term care, based on the aging demographic, where we think that will be. And again, we expect that caseload overall will close to double from about 26,000 now to over nearly 45,000 by 2040. This is a very important point in terms of all of our long-range planning. Oregon serves about, on the aging side, about 3.9 or almost 4% of people over age 65 receive paid public assistance for long-term care. But all of the data shows that about 25% of the 65-plus population requires some level of assistance with daily living. So again, the vast majority of seniors who require some assistance are getting that from family, friends, natural caregivers, not part of the paid public system. And that becomes a very important point in terms of long-range planning, because if we can't sort of contain the growth of the Medicaid side of the expenditures as our caseloads double, and provide other kinds of supports that will help people stay safe, independent at home, not spend down, become eligible for Medicaid. And that's where much of our long-range planning effort has focused, is on that pre-Medicaid group that needs, in many cases, lots of assistance, but have not yet come into the public arena in terms of long-term care. And then on page 9, just again, this sort of gets back to Representative Amaro's point, is just the relative distribution of Medicaid dollars under our current system, where you can see Oregon compared to national averages in terms of expenditures on the community versus institutional side. But the point that we've always tried to make is Oregon's system is not based overall on high per capita expenditures nationally. These figures are a little dated. They date back to 2005 in the chart below the line, but they show Oregon is not nearly at the top in terms of expenditures. It's how we spend our dollars in Oregon, not how much we spend, that really has been the hallmark of Oregon's system, with its emphasis on in-home care and non-institutional care. The recommendations in the long-range plan, and I won't walk through the details again, I just want to provide sort of a high summary set of recommendations. They break really into five areas. One was, and Representative Cowan mentioned, Oregon, for all its attention and national attention in terms of its long-term care system, our system has really begun to crumble, not only at the edges, but more deeply than that within recent years. And it really is the phenomena of private pay versus Medicaid. Our Medicaid rates for community-based care have been fairly flat, while the private pay rates are going up very quickly. And, of course, the demand on the private pay side is going to be huge. And so we will always be trying to play catch-up to the private pay side. So Medicaid is not kept up. We began to see in sort of the graphic example in Representative Cowan's district, but also elsewhere, that much of our community system started to shift to private pay because Medicaid rate was not coming, and we were seeing an actual significant decline in the number of slots or beds available in our community care system, as well as a beginning spike in nursing home utilization, the first increases that we had seen in over 20 years. So that set off a lot of alarm bells. We spent a lot of time thinking about that during the supplemental session, and then during the interim committees looked at this a lot. The supplemental session did forwarded a rate increase of $260 per person per day in our community-based care system that actually, based right now, appears to have stabilized. We've not had more declines in our Medicaid capacity, and we've actually seen some increased capacity in assisted living and foster care. So that is a huge relief in trying to provide a short-term fix. But then we're also looking longer term. Since 2001, we've had a moratorium on building any new assisted living or residential care facilities. We had a huge building boom during the 90s, lots of lenders out there funding new capacity, and we overbuilt the system for a while. Then there was declining occupancy in facilities, and financially they got in trouble, so together the industry and the department and the legislature crafted a moratorium in early 2000. And the special session, the supplemental session, ended that moratorium saying, now we're actually seeing a shrinkage of capacity. We need to, again, begin to build for future demand. But, of course, with the housing market right now, that's probably not going to happen in the short term. But the moratorium ended December 31st. We've crafted new rules for new licenses as new proposed facilities will come online. And then the other direction from the last legislature and in Senate Bill 1061 was to develop a whole new rate methodology. The rate methodology in our community-based care system really hadn't been looked at for some years, and the whole direction is to develop a rate structure that is finely tuned to a person's acuity level so that it really changes, and it changes responsively and timely as a person's needs change. Because we're beginning to see our community-based care system say, we can no longer serve people with such high acuity needs with an outdated rate structure, and when you can get so much more on the private pay side. And of course, that means that people would have nowhere else to go but to institutional care at two or three times the cost. So beginning to rebalance that. We've spent a lot of work on that. We're not yet finished. We have a couple more stakeholder meetings. I think we're getting close to developing a new rate structure, which, again, will have different base rates and then bumps in those rates based on discrete differences in complexity of care. But it does mean over time that rate structure will have to grow, and it's difficult to talk about in this budget climate, but that rate structure, which now averages between 1,000 and 2,000, will have to grow to between $1,500 and up to $3,000, depending on the acuity level over time. If again, we're going to continue to serve people with complex needs in community-based care. That plan, that recommendation, will be coming to you all and to the Ways and Means Committee within the next month or two. So that's part of the plan as well. Then the other components of the plan, and I'll come back to the pre-Medicaid side, a lot of discussion about recruitment, retention of a workforce. Probably even scarier than the aging demographic is looking at the labor demographics and just saying, where are we going to get the entry-level workforce in many parts of Oregon, and not only rural areas, but also the metropolitan area. We've suffered a lot of staff shortages, high vacancy rates over recent years, and of course that's a dangerous mix if you're serving complex people. So there's a lot of focus on what strategies we're going to develop to better retain and recruit and train a workforce. And again, that's part wages and benefits, but it also has a lot to do with training. And those strategies are still under discussion, and we'll have more specific proposals as time goes on. We also had a component of the plan that said we critically need to address mental health and addictions. That's one of sort of the unsung issues, the number of seniors and people with disabilities suffering alcoholism and other addictions is growing very rapidly, and yet our mental health system, with all of its other struggles, has not been able to really address the needs of this population. And then more broadly, there's components of the plan that just talk about all the other issues to build livable communities for vulnerable population and that populations, and that includes transportation and all of those kinds of things. We did also, with the Department of Transportation, it was another budget note, develop a very detailed plan looking at Oregon's future transportation needs for this population. And that is quite alarming as well when you look at the gap between our current transportation infrastructure and what's needed. And of course, if we're going to keep seniors at home and safe and independent, being able to get to the doctor and go shopping and all of those things will become even more critical. Then finally, and sort of leading up to Representative Cowan's proposals, we spent a lot of time saying, what does the pre-Medicaid system need to look like? Oregon, again, is famous for its Medicaid system. Quite frankly, other states have done a much better job than we have in looking at all seniors and people with disabilities and providing some meaningful support long before they spend down, become eligible for Medicaid, and need public assistance. And in that part of the plan, we really focused on three areas. One was to develop case managers or counselors in every area of the state with very high visibility that are instantly available to seniors, people with disabilities, and their family members when that crisis or need for long-term care occurs. It amazes us every day about how many times mom breaks her hip, she's in the hospital, needs some immediate care needs, and families absolutely melt down. Don't know what to do, don't know where to go, don't know who to call. And again, our system is all sort of geared around the public assistance part, for which they're not eligible, so they don't get meaningful assistance there. And this, frequently we also get calls for relatives or sons and daughters out of state where mom or dad needs help in Oregon, and they're just in a complete panic state. And we need a robust network of resources that instantly helps those people, because if you don't select the best care options, the least expensive, then the chances they'll go into a much more expensive care setting, spend down, and then become eligible for Medicaid and create, you know, the budgetary pressures on our side. So that is a hallmark of our planning on the pre-Medicaid population. We're also saying we need to put together what we call a very sophisticated call center where you can sort of triage those kind of calls, have experts available, not to do 5-10 minute calls, but 20, 30, 40 minute kinds of calls to really assess what the crisis in the family is, hook them up with local resources, and again, try to help individuals long before they spend down and need Medicaid. And then as part of that pre-Medicaid, we've also said we also need some direct resources. Probably the best example that Oregon is famous for is Oregon Project Independence, which is a pre-Medicaid program. It's not very expensive. We don't spend very much money on it. The average amount of resources people get is maybe between $200 and $250 to provide some chore services, some in-home services, and that will keep seniors and people with disabilities independent and safe at home for much longer of periods. And quite frankly, we also see people that are Medicaid eligible but would rather take some small amount of resources and not spend down and stay at home. And there's nothing...
James, I'm going to stop you for a minute because I think there might be some new people here who might not understand what Project Independence is. Could you just give us a brief overview, when it started, what it does, who it serves?
Oregon Project Independence started in 1975 or 73. I think it was 75. It was long before there was a Medicaid program. We didn't expend any public funds in community-based care at that point. All of our public expenditures were in nursing homes. So Oregon Project Independence was a small start to provide primarily some counseling assistance and case management and in-home support to pay for in-home care, assistance in shopping, chore services, things of that sort. It sort of topped out at about $12 or $13 million some years ago. It's kind of gone up and down with the ebb and flow of the budgets since that time. But again, it's a very popular program because you don't have to go into a Medicaid office, you don't have to sign your life away, you don't have to promise to open up your estate after you die, which you have to do when you enter the Medicaid program. So it's a very popular program and it's only at this point in time, it's limited to seniors over age 62 or younger persons with Alzheimer's. The legislature two sessions ago added people with disabilities that could be served under Oregon Project Independence, but only if the fund grew. It's not grown since that time, and so people with disabilities have not been added.
And talk some about the different levels of services provided or needed.
In Oregon Project Independence, well, again, it's primarily in-home care.
I realize that, but isn't there a level that goes like down to 17?
Madam Chair, yes. The level of assistance to be eligible for Oregon Project Independence is identical to the level of care you need to receive paid public assistance. So you actually have to be assessed in those needs for daily living, activities of daily living, the survival priority levels that I talked about a little bit before of 1 through 17. Apply also for people before. So there is an assessment, there's an eligibility, but it's not tied to finances or spending down to be eligible for that program.
And is that in here somewhere so people can see that? Because I think later on we'll be talking about how at some levels we discontinue providing services or only provide services from 1 through
Madam Chair, that's correct. When the reductions were made in the 2003 session and we cut off levels 14 through 17, so people that had minimal needs in bathing and dressing and things of that sort actually lost service Many of them have since come back because they deteriorated and then needed more expensive care. But when we did that, we didn't crosswalk that to Oregon Project Independence. We felt it was very important to still maintain some level of support through OPI, again, with its limited fund base, for those lower impairment levels who are now not eligible for the Medicaid part of the system.
Madam Chair, I'm sure that service priority level chart will magically appear for this this committee somewhere along the way, and then we'll have that reference document. I'm not sure where they come from, but I have two or three, so I'm sure that someone in this crowd will make this happen.
Right. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, may I have permission to be slightly political in this political body?
Oh.
I'll make it simple. OPI has been a political football, and it need not be a political football. I mean, I don't think there's any... There's not going to be any dissent on this panel when you understand the consequences of this program. And I wish we would bring it out of that environment and deal with it appropriately.
Thank you. We will try. Sorry, couldn't help that.
Thank you. Any other questions while we stop? All right, James. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, and Oregon Project Independence continues. Several years ago, an effort was made to actually expand it by tapping the senior tax property tax deferral account if there were excess revenues to bolster it. Unfortunately, all of us then swapped out the general fund and just loaded it up on that account, and now it's declining. It's going to go from about 13, well, actually, it topped out at about $20 million. There will only be about $7.4 million available in this next year. So if we add no general fund back, the current spending level of OPI, which is $12.6 million, will go to about $7.4 million. So, again, it's an unstable fund source. But we emphasize, again, in this plan for looking at the future, that ought to be really sort of the gateway to assist people before they spend down and need Medicaid. And finally, there's a variety of other sort of pre-Medicaid things in here, providing caregiver support. Again, if you have 25% of the population that needs support, only 4% are getting paid public assistance. That means lots of family members and relatives are out there providing care. And we have some wonderful caregiver support models in Oregon that provide peer support, training. We need to provide respite care, anything we can to keep those caregivers intact, to keep families intact, because obviously the pressures on caregivers are immense. And then we're also working on a set of healthy aging strategies as well. We launched Tai Chi programs in four pilot counties from a model grant from the federal government. And there's a lot of effort at the national level to look at how we invest in falls prevention, which is one of the primary drivers of people needing long-term care. They fall, they break something, and they never rebound to the level that they originally had. So that's all part of the mix in the recommendations of the pre-Medicaid program. And finally, I'll just end with, on the last page, and I won't go through the details again, is just the bullets or the summary amounts of each of the budget packages. Senate Bill 1061 required us to cost out in detail each of these proposals, which we did. Actually, these were all included in the department's recommended budget. That's kind of history now with the revenue situation that's facing us. But nonetheless, we had, if you added it up, it was about $121 million in general fund recommendations to implement all these proposals. And the stakeholder group, and I'm sure they'll amplify that, said, you know, we really needed to prioritize that over multiple biennia, but still come back and say these are the key elements of the plan, no matter what sequence exactly we use to fund these. And again, that looks like a big price tag, but the entire long-term care system right now for 2007-09 was about $3 billion. So about $120 million of general fund to fix, stabilize, and build a pre-Medicaid program for the future out of a $3 billion budget. In that context, is not that big a deal. In the revenue situation we're facing now, it's a very big deal. But just to sort of put some perspective that I think all of us in the stakeholders did a very good job of coming up with a fairly narrow list of priorities. So with that, Madam Chair, unless there's other questions, I'll
Great. I'm going to invite us not to get into the budget issues right now, and I would invite other presenters, because what we're trying to do today is get an overall view of the care for seniors and folks with disabilities. So rather than advocating for certain programs, what I'd like to do is hear about programs and other issues. But let's not talk too much today about the budget issues. Representative Van Orman.
Madam Chair, I just would like to make sure that I understand. GF is general fund, correct. OF other funds, FF federal funds, and TF total funds.
Thank you so much. Very good.
Just want to make sure.
And I want to invite other people to talk in words and not in letters. And if you've got letters written down, be sure and let us all know what those letters mean.
Madam
Representative
Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Could we establish that OPI is a word for the purpose of this panel's discussion?
Yes, I think so.
Thank you.
Oregon Project Independence.
Madam Chair, yes. It's not about a specific program, but Representative Cowan, and I think we recognize this, and she said that if we don't front-load, you know, with OPI or whatever these community-based service, they go into the more expensive care of nursing homes. Makes sense, common sense. And she said over the long term. But my question is, how quickly will that number go up in the nursing home side if we are to cut that community-based service? You know, because we're talking about budgets today, not budgets down the road. And do we have an estimate on how quickly that will jump up?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, we use a fairly expansive definition of people eligible for nursing home care because of this artifact of federal law that you have to use the same eligibility criteria for community-based care for people needing Medicaid. So there's not a one-for-one correlation all the time. For example, when we cut levels 14 through 17, and initially, I think we cut about 5,000 people off of, or sent notices to 5,000 people, and then there was a lesser number that actually lost service. You didn't see that whole group quickly go into nursing homes because a person with some minimal needs and bathing and dressing, things like that, has real needs but probably won't require nursing home care, although they were eligible. Any one of them could have walked into a nursing home and they were Medicaid eligible and we would have had to have served them there. As we start cutting into higher impairment levels, and that's going to be the big debate about the whole senior disability budget this session, is where we've taken the reductions, because many of the calculations always were on those hydraulics. Well, if I cut this, will that automatically mean X percentage of people will go into institutional care? And we've tried to estimate those puts and takes, but the hydraulic that traps us in the senior and disability system always is, if a state takes $1 of Medicaid anywhere for medical care, acute care, anywhere else, nursing home services is a mandatory service. So there is no equivocation there. Anybody that's Medicaid eligible can walk into a nursing home, and we cannot deny that right. So as we tamper with the community-based care side, or it destabilizes, or we defund it, we have a huge risk of those costs just shooting into the stratosphere on the institutional side, and we have absolutely no legal control over that.
Thank you, James. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that extensive presentation, Mr. Taves. So much of it is really, it's heartening for me to hear that you're addressing this so comprehensively. One of the challenges that I see in the at-home care environment is the ability to integrate with health professionals. Right, that as we're moving hopefully towards more concepts of integrated healthcare, I'm just wondering where the care deliverer who's at home, whether it's a family member or a home healthcare worker, to what extent they're really considered part of a larger team, and where there's a lot of communication between them and the health network or the particular doctor or whatever. It seems that the more communication you could have in that environment, the more successfully you could keep people at home.
Madam Chair, Representative, we actually, as a stakeholder group, have talked a lot about that, and we had some draft proposals that didn't go over very well, and talking about almost throwing both community-based care and medical care into managed care and capitation, and that just led to lots of issues. But right now, we are, first of all, our community partners, the area agencies on aging and our field offices, I mean, those case managers do a lot of that kind of running between the acute and long-term care system already. But we're also in active discussion with several of the Oregon health plans to actually talk about, can we look at cohorts of people that have, because again, many people in long-term care have three or more chronic diseases. So chronic disease management, things of that sort becomes really, really important. And we're actually looking at strategies where we can identify those people and then create a tighter network between the medical community and and we see key examples of that. If you look at the elder place model at Providence, which is sort of a boutique model in some sense, but nonetheless, when you look, and they have totally integrated care, and they integrate Medicare, Medicaid, all acute care. Their physician panels, I think, are 80 per physician. When you look at their nursing home usage, emergency room hospitalization rates, they're way lower, much lower than than seniors and people with disabilities, their counterparts on the community side. So it is absolutely essential that we link that, but we have not gone nearly far enough in doing that. And how we can do that without accelerating fears that we're just going to put everything into managed care and seniors and people with disabilities will lose all their choices about their long-term care needs is still kind of the discussion we're having.
Thank you very much, James. Colleagues, James is in the area, so we can call him to testify at another time. So if we have further questions, we can call him back. So, James, I'm going to excuse you unless you have any closing comments. And somebody, whoever did this, put up your hand. I'd like to see who was the good person who brought these out. Thank you.
I told you these just appear by magic every time you mention it.
This is what I was referencing, and this is very important. So be sure
those are the service priority levels that we
use. Right. So thank you to whomever did this. Colleagues, we're going to rush along because we have just a little bit over an hour, and obviously there are many people here who would like to speak. I think we have a list of 10 witnesses, and we have five panelists. Okay, I'm going to ask them to come up quickly. I think that we're going to take Rick Bennett and Art Tower, and then I'm going to let you decide who's going to be the third person on this panel. And we're going to ask you to speak quickly so that we know that we've got time for people who I know have come, some from long distances. And did anybody sign up who has traveled more than, I think we usually say 100 miles, anybody who's traveled more than 55 miles who is going to be here wanting to speak, seeing that, because we would take those persons first. Okay. Third person is on that panel. It can be.
I think they're going to bring the other three together.
All right. Fine.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. First of all, I'd like to recognize Representative Cowan as well as Senator Morissette and their committees during the interim for the excellent work that they've done, and their efforts I think are greatly appreciated by all stakeholders. I'd also like to recognize James Taves and his staff. At times there is a certain amount of friction between stakeholders and the division and so forth, but their willingness to listen to concerns and work with us has I've been very impressed with it, particularly over the past year, and I want to recognize their efforts as well. I've been asked to provide a little more detail related to the campaign for Oregon seniors and people with disabilities, and then Arthur and others, I think, will speak to the efforts and concerns of the more the hands-on providers, as it were, and their perspectives related to the long-term care system here in Oregon. Again, we certainly appreciate the opportunity to come before you and provide you an overview on the on senior services and Oregon's long-term care system. This conversation, as James Taves mentioned, actually goes back nearly 30 years ago. And if you have a chance, if you haven't done so, I would certainly encourage you to take a look at ORS Chapter 410, at least the opening sections related to state policy and how that policy would be implemented. Looking at that, and now, to some extent, it seems fairly obvious and commonplace, but 25, 30 years ago, it was really groundbreaking. I think we all understand, though, that we can't rest on our past work. As already mentioned, I think our long-term care system, its emphasis on home and community-based services, is in jeopardy. We have, over the past few years, we have not continued to invest in that system and maintain it, nor enhance it. So, at the end of the last session, many of us who advocate on behalf of seniors and people with disabilities came together. We talked with Representative Cowan and other legislators. Obviously, we were somewhat disappointed with our efforts to make progress during the 07 session. And there was thinking that perhaps we needed to look at how we move forward in the future. And out of that discussion came the campaign for seniors and people with disabilities. It's a rather diverse group of providers and industry, labor, consumers. And obviously, when you have a diverse group like that, there are going to be many ideas as far as what the needs are and how they should be addressed. And first of all, we spent a great deal of time in facilitated discussions taking all those various needs. And in fact, literally 70, 80 pieces of paper, you know, up on the wall and so forth. Everything was put on the table, but we were also realistic that you can't do everything. Through that facilitated discussion, we identified several key areas that we felt were the priorities and some action items within each of those areas. That those included, and actually James touched on them in his testimony, certainly includes maximizing access, Medicaid access. That means enhancing the non-Medicaid services, workforce development, community mental health services, as well as affordable housing and special needs transportation. And during the February session, I think we made some progress in those key areas. Certainly the passage of Senate Bill 1061 and its call for a comprehensive plan was significant, as well as the reallocation of some of the dollars from the Human Services Rebalance Plan. And quite frankly, advocates were looking forward to this session to continue that effort. An effort, as I said, to try and reinvest and to restore funding that had been lost in the last economic downturn and to move forward. And obviously, in the last several months, it looks like that may be very difficult to do. I think most of us have been involved in the process for some time. We understand the realities of revenue and budgeting and so forth. And I think we really need, as a campaign, I think the advocates need to have further discussion to reassess what we can do to move forward versus what we need to do to make sure that we don't take steps backwards. And certainly all we have at the moment is the governor's recommended budget. I'm hopeful that that is just a starting point. But when we look at the recommended budget, the cuts being suggested for seniors and people with disabilities, those services, are dramatic. Nearly 18% reduction. There is going to be, obviously, dramatic human impact. But there's also an economic impact as well. And one of the things I wanted to mention to the committee today is one of the things that the campaign has done, and that's related to an economic impact study that we have funded through Echo Northwest. And what that study does is look at the impact of the federal matching dollars. Medicaid programs, as you know, for each dollar the state puts in general fund dollars, receives approximately $1.65, $1.70 from the federal government. Obviously, that is a significant help to providing services. And at the same time, when you start cutting budgets and cutting general fund dollars, you lose those federal funds. And the impact study showed just what that impact could be. Using the governor's budget as just a snapshot, if the proposed recommendations were approved, we would lose nearly $600 million in federal funds. Those are dollars that go directly into communities across the state. And in those communities, they continue to circulate and create economic activity. You lose those dollars, you lose that economic activity. You also lose jobs. Based on the data from this economic study, and again using the governor's recommended budget as a snapshot or an example, the study suggests that you would lose over 11,000 jobs in these communities as well. And at a time when we're looking to stimulate the economy and create jobs, that seems to be going in the wrong direction. So not only do you have concerns related to the human need and the impact of possible budget cuts, you also have the economic impact as well. We know that Oregon's long-term care system is the right system. It's a system designed to honor the independence, choice, and dignity of our seniors and people with disabilities by allowing home and community-based alternatives to more expensive nursing home facilities. It's a system that's the envy of the nation, and other states are trying to adopt it. It's a system that is highly effective and fiscally responsible in that it saves taxpayer dollars and leverages major federal funding. I would hope, as I said, that we can, in fact, continue to move forward. I'm very concerned about us losing ground because of the current economic situation. I hope as we move forward, we'll all be working together to find a fair solution to our budget problem. One of the things before I close, I want James Tays mentioned at the beginning of his testimony, he's talking about the balancing between institutional or facility care versus home and community-based care. And AARP last year completed a study called the Balancing Act. And some of your committee members have already received this. I think it does provide a very good discussion related to that balancing of institutional versus in-home and community-based care. And if you like, I'll see if we have additional copies for the new members of your committee as
that
well.
That would be great. Yeah. I already have one. I have both one. Of us. You have one, Michael?
No.
Oh, yes, for the new members at least, please get those.
I'll be happy to do so. Again, in closing, please know that we understand that our state is facing extremely challenging economic times that will require tough choices of policymakers and advocates alike. But we urge you to take a long, hard look at what Oregon's home and community-based care system brings and means to vulnerable Oregons, as well as our state's workers and communities and economy. Again, we appreciate your support and look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick. Thank you. James, I know that the video is not available to show today, and that's really disappointing, but you're going to get copies of the video. That sounds yes. Great. Okay, I'm going to ask each presenter to tell me how much time you need, and I'm going to keep you to that because I want to make sure that we have time for all the people who have signed up to speak. So how much time do you think you need?
4 minutes.
You've got it.
Okay. Okay, my name is Arthur Towers. For the record, I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And I am going to edit my remarks because all the good stuff's been said. But I do want to point out that SEIU represents about 15,000 care providers in Oregon, 10,000 home care workers, 3,700 adult foster care providers, and about 1,000 nursing home workers. And we're proud to be part of the campaign for Oregon seniors and people with disabilities because we deeply value our partnership with advocates in order to speak with one voice for high quality and accessible care. I also really want to thank Representative Cowan, Senator Morissette, for their leadership on this issue. One thing that kind of gets lost in this is the humanity of what we're talking about, and Ms. West will forward a video around that really touches on that. But I urge you to take a moment to listen to Representative Cowan's story. I had the privilege of traveling out to Newport and visiting with her and hearing how these issues affected her family, not just her elderly relatives, but also her daughter and the role that her daughter played in providing care. And I think that it takes a special person with something special in their heart to do this sort of work, not just for family members, but for strangers as well, people who start out as strangers. And so in about a week and a half, we have a number of care providers coming to the Capitol, as they like to do. And I really hope that you get a chance to stop and visit with them, because the stories that they can tell you about what this work is actually like on a day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year basis are really incredible. I want to touch on a point Representative Dembro made about the role of community-based care and in-home care as the canary in the mineshaft of the health of elderly and disabled Oregonians. These are oftentimes the frontline care providers who can catch an illness or a change in condition that might not otherwise be caught very quickly because they have daily contact or a couple times a week contact with someone whose health is declining. I also wanted to touch on, provide a little bit more clarity on the various forms of home care that the state provides, because we had some conversation about Oregon Project Independence. The state has two large home care programs. One is the Client Employee Provider Program for Medicaid clients. Serves right now about 10,000 Oregonians. Oregon Project Independence serves about 3,000 Oregonians. In the larger Medicaid program that qualifies for federal matching funds, again, just to give you a sense, more than half, under the proposed budget, more than half of those clients would be denied care if the budget proposal goes through.
All right, is that in here, the materials that you gave us? If not, could you send us a bullet point stating those facts?
Will do.
Thank you.
I do want to point out that voters endorsed this system and mandated improvements through the passage of Constitutional Amendment 99 in 2000, passed 6337 with a majority in every county. Also want to point out that while only 4% of seniors and people with disabilities at any one time need Medicaid help, oftentimes people will outlive their spouse and outlive their money. And that's going to be much more common here in the future as the boomers retire. And so we'll be needing the Medicaid care. The last, I want to make two more points. One is on quality. And quality is a big deal for our members. They bargained away in their first contract, the home care providers, bargained away a bigger raise in order to get paid training because they want to improve the quality of care. And so keeping an eye on quality is important because over the course of the last couple of years, we've had a big increase in quality. Why? Because, A, there's paid training for people, and, B, there's reduced turnover. And that is a huge difference. Before Measure 99 passed, turnover was like McDonald's-style turnover. And why? Because it was low-wage work. You weren't even covered if you got injured on the job, no benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And the real tipping point was when home care workers bargained for fully paid health premiums for themselves and for their kids. They top out at $10.24 an hour. And so under any other circumstance, they couldn't afford even a partial payment on their premium. And so when they were able to do that, then they were able to hang on in the job, stick with it, and not take a complete and utter vow of poverty to keep on doing what they had in their heart to do. And so that was a big change, I think, in terms of maintaining a quality workforce. And one of our next goals is to make the same sort of improvement in adult foster care so we don't have the retention issues in that area, as Representative Cowan touched on. And the final issue that I want to touch on in the remaining 5 minutes of my 4 minutes has to do with the economic impact of this. And, you know, I did want to touch on the people part of it, but also the economic part of it is a reality of what we're looking at here. Mr. Bennett and others have talked about this in terms of the economic activity. But I do want to point out this is a rural and an urban issue. In my testimony, I had a couple a map, a chart that shows the where the caseload is county by county, a randomly selected list of counties of represented by members on this committee, and also the map of employment patterns in long-term care. And note that we have four counties where employment in long-term care field exceeds 5% of total employment, and that's Coos, Josephine, Wasco, and Wheeler. And so that, you know, if these sorts of cuts go through, it's going to be devastating for rural communities, and, you know, more so like the fabric of life, right? I mean, the idea that I can't stay in the town I live in because I can't get the care I need, okay? It's a tragedy for our communities. I don't care which community you live in. That is a very sad state of affairs, and we have the power between the folks behind us and the folks on the dais to address that issue. And one other piece around the...
Very fast.
Is the connection between health care and home care, adult foster care, long-term care. This is an entry-level job for the longer-haul issue of how we're going to address health care issues in the statewide. If we, this last chart is employment projections in Oregon, and setting the recession aside for a second, all the growth is in occupational and physical therapy assistance, up 34%. The need will grow. Healthcare support occupations, we need 31% increase there. Nursing, psychiatric, and home health aides, 29% growth. And so if we can keep these folks who are currently doing this work in these various settings trained, employed on the job, that's going to be the pool so that we can provide health care as efforts through House Bill 2009 and on the federal level to expand access occur. So thank you very much.
The longest 4 minutes of my life.
That's mine too.
Thank you both.
Madam Chair, thank you so much.
Thank you. Art is in the building too. If we need to hear more from him later to ask questions, we'll bring him in. Okay, we have next three. We have Nicole, Ozzy, and Rob Johnson. And I'm going to ask each of you how much time you need. And I'm going to do, hopefully, a better job than I did with Mr. Towers.
Madam Chair, while they're settling, may I ask a question or make a comment?
Yes.
It's not a question. I just think that, and Art kind of touched on it, I made myself a note, is something we need to keep in mind is, and find out from people, what is the tipping point that we're going to need the absolute minimum level of funding to continue services so we don't tip it down and turn more people into needing more state services. I think that's the balancing act that we need to
Great point. All right, you choose who will speak first and tell me how many. In fact, go along and tell me how many minutes you need, and I'm going to write it down.
For the record, my name is Rob Johnson, and I'm going to try to take half of Arthur's time, so I'll just take 2 minutes.
I'll give you three.
Challenge here now.
Nicole Armstrong with O4AD, and I think 2 minutes ought to do it.
All right.
I am Ozzy Rose in disguise, Ruth Golias, representing Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, and with me is David Fuchs, and in total, we could use about 6 minutes.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I guess for the record, my name is Rob Johnson. I'm here representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent about 585 licensed long-term care facilities, which range from nursing facilities, assisted living, residential care, in-home care agencies, and senior retirement housing. I've provided for you a handout that gives you a little bit more background on the system of long-term care facilities in Oregon generally. But I'd like to talk specifically about our participation in the campaign and touch on some of the economic activity that you heard a little bit about from Art and Rick. Our members employ close to 25,000 Oregonians and provide services to just about that many every month. And we've been a participant in the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities since its inception and have had some degree of success at the legislature, I think as a result of the diversity of our coalition. We participated in the plan, in the comprehensive planning process that James Taves talked about earlier, and I think there's a lot of good information in that document. A couple of things to point out about Oregon's long-term care system. The first is that because it's a person-to-person enterprise, the economic activity that's generated as a result is very high. I know Rick and Art talked about the amount of economic stimulus that it provides and the amount of jobs that it provides. And just to kind of give you a little bit different framework, for every $1 million that the state appropriates to long-term care services, it creates about 30 jobs. And you can extrapolate that based on whichever budget number you're talking about. In sort of the same light, for every $1 million in funding that the long-term care system gets, it creates about $1.7 million in economic activity. And most of that is taken up, about two-thirds of that is taken up by wages, direct wages. And again, I'll restate what I said before. It's a person-to-person enterprise, which means that the vast majority of expenditures on behalf of long-term care facilities in the state are workforce-related, so wages, benefits, et cetera. A couple of other things to mention. Oregon's long-term care system, cuts in the long-term care system, disproportionately affect two groups. One is rural counties, and I know that Art talked about that a little bit, but the reason is because employment in rural counties is made up, a higher percentage is made up by the long-term care workforce, and so when there are cuts in the budget, the rural communities are affected disproportionately. And the second thing to point out is that cuts in these areas disproportionately affect women as well for two reasons. One is that the long-term care workforce is made up mostly by women, and the second is that women make up a much higher percentage of the long-term care resident population than men do. I guess in closing, I would just say that I think we are proud to be a participant in the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities, and we look forward to working with all of you in the future, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Representative Ben Orman.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to know, of your 585 members, how many are nonprofit and how many are for-profit?
We represent mostly for-profit corporations, okay. Although I would say a small percentage of our membership is nonprofit. Ruth's Association represents most of the nonprofit organizations.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Great. Thank you so much. Very good job. I'm going to hold up one finger when it says you've got 1 minute left, okay?
All right.
That's not daunting at all.
That's not what?
That's not daunting at all.
Oh, okay.
For the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. We consider O4AD a word because it's just too long to say all the time. We are here to represent the 17 area agencies, and we are all around the state. We serve every county in the state, serving seniors and people with physical disabilities. Up and down the I-5 corridor, we also have taken on Medicaid eligibility for the state. We do that as a partner to the state. Therefore, we represent the largest majority of the clients that we serve, and it's our case managers that have that interaction on a day-to-day basis, and we interact with our partners very much. Our case managers help people get to Oregon Healthcare Association's facilities or the alliances. Home care workers, we interact with SEIU's home care workers who do a tremendous service to these individuals through the Medicaid programs and through OPI. and we are pleased to be a part of the campaign. I've had a chance to speak to most of you, so I won't go through the whole spiel of who we are, just to say that we have a strong investment in what's going to happen this session to these individuals, because we know their cases, we know who they are, we see them on a day-to-day basis, and we're very interested in how to mitigate the damage that might happen this session, but we're also very interested in the conversation about how do we make this system stronger and better so that we aren't coming back with these questions all the time. And that's going to be a question of program, that's going to be a question of planning, and frankly, it's going to be a question of budget and revenue. So we look forward to having that conversation with you. You'll hear from some of my members regarding Representative Cowan's bill in a little bit, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole. Representative Booth.
Nicole, are you continuing, is O4AD continuing the Network of Care program?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, yes, we are currently still participating in that program.
Thanks. And Van Orman.
Madam Chair, do you all receive county funding?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, I'm looking for an answer back here. It varies. It varies depending upon which of the area agencies you're speaking of. There are different relationships in different areas, and I could certainly find that out for your area.
And could you send it to our wonderful staff here, and she will share it with
Absolutely.
All of us. Thank you, Nicole. Good job. Okay.
For the record, I'm Ruth Gullius, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, representing the not-for-profit mission-directed providers of long-term care throughout the state. And as Rob, we represent a full continuum of senior services, nursing home, assisted living, residential care, low-income subsidized housing, and home care agencies. And I think that really summarizes that the whole array of services is what's absolutely critical for seniors' needs, because seniors' needs differ. And their needs are present every day, and that's why we're so concerned about some of the decisions that are in front of us. There are, with some of the cuts that are in front of us, there are thousands of people that are residing in nursing homes, assisted living, residential care, who have very high intensive needs, who can't wait for an economic turnaround, and should Medicaid eligibility change for them, where would they go? A big concern as we're going forward. I wanted to give you two examples of two types of members and what their current situation is like, sort of in the dollars and people world. As Rob said, this would adversely affect folks in rural Oregon. So these are actually two examples of members from rural Oregon. One is an assisted living provider who manages six assisted living residential cares, primarily in rural Oregon. This community has targeted Medicaid. Medicaid is very important in their communities, and they don't really have the option of withdrawing. One of their assisted living facilities in Hines no longer has a nursing home, is the only facility that could serve Medicaid residents except for maybe a small residential care facility in a nearby town. In order for this facility to break even in the coming year and slowly build its reserves, it plans to increase its private pay rates by 8% rather than the usual 5%, because Medicaid rates, the gap between Medicaid and private pay has been growing. Another community in Myrtle Creek, their private pay rates are scheduled to increase by 9% this year to make up that difference. And I want to thank Representative Cowan and Representative Morissette for the bump, much needed bump, that we received in funding in the 2008 session. There's still a shortfall. There's still a big gap, and an important one. And a example in Myrtle Creek, they lost over $80,000 this year. I wanted to use an example of a nursing facility, again in rural Oregon. They receive $31 per resident a day less than the actual care of providing services. That translates into an estimated shortfall of almost $420,000 for this upcoming year. Again, any cuts really challenge the viability of this community to continue to provide services in a rural community. Wanted to just give you two examples of the reality that's being experienced out there right now, and then I wanted to turn it over to David Fuchs, who chairs our legislative committee, who will speak to his perspective as a provider of multi-level campus here in Portland. Thank you.
Welcome, David.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm David Fuchs. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Cedars-Sinai Park, Legislative Chair of the Alliance. and active in a lot of other ways. There's not time to go through all of it. In fact, there's not a lot of time. If I had time, I would talk to you about the enormous challenge that we face as a provider of 600 people every day with 250 employees providing services, and what a challenge that is. But there isn't time for that, so I have to be focused. If I had time, I'd explain to you that we lose $1.5 million a year providing services to indigent elders because the difference between Medicaid rates and what it takes to really provide care, and that we I'd explain to you if I had time that we raise $1 million a year and fill that gap because we're a faith-based organization, and the fifth commandment was not a suggestion. We take it pretty seriously, and we run some of our services. We have, I have 1 minute. We run some of our services profitably so that we can subvent the losses of other services. But there isn't time for that. So what do I have time to tell you? What I have time to tell you is that we've had enormous wage inflation over the last several years, particularly in health care. It's a big challenge for us, and the result is that it just costs a lot to provide services. We do the best we can, but we need the state of the help. The help of the state. In addition, in my last few seconds, want to tell you that we have to have a long view. We can't just think of ourselves as providing a continuum of care. We have to build a constellation of services that makes it possible for us to provide services with choices to people so that they can live at home wherever they want to call home, and they can do it successfully. Yes, there's a lot of pressure on us right now. This year, we have to face that pressure and deal with it, but we've got a tsunami coming of demand, and we have to maintain the system of care in order to build upon that base, not erode that system. And I guess I'm out of time. Thank you.
You are. Thank you so much, and thank you all as a panel. It would be really helpful. David, I think I'm very interested, and I imagine other people might be too. It's helpful for us to have one page with bullet points. I mean, you talk about, and I've heard this from other people also, how you have to charge more people who are paying to offset what you're losing for the Medicaid patients. It would be really helpful for us if we could see that in black and white so we have some sense of that. That would be great.
Madam Chair, we're glad to do that. And I want to share with you that our for-profit colleagues are doing much of that as well, that there is cross-subsidization taking place, and that sense of mission really permutes through the entire provider community.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay, I am going to close the informational hearing and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2391. We have a little bit. Oh, stay right there, Representative. I'm going to put you right there. Stay right there because we're going to hear just briefly about this bill, if that's okay with you, because we have 9 people who are scheduled to speak. And is that okay with you?
Are we going to take testimony on the bill?
I mean, we have a public hearing. We have to take testimony.
We have to take testimony. Yeah. Yeah. We have to on the public hearing. That's what I've been told. Yeah. So and 9 people have signed up.
So what are you going to do?
So I'm going to have you briefly talk about this bill. We're going to make it clear that this bill is just, we're just starting the process.
Right.
Well, I guess I should open up the public hearing on House Bill
2391. So you want me to do it from here then?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Just so we can save time. So
I just want my directions here.
Yes, I know.
Which place I'm sitting.
Yes. So, again, colleagues, we are just, and audience, we are just starting the process in this bill. It's nowhere close to getting to the point where it's going to pass. So if there are things in this bill you absolutely hate, you know, that's okay. Let us know, but we're going to be dealing with those things that you love. Let us know that, too. But the bill is nowhere close to the point where it's going to be passing.
This is
kind of weird. With that...
That's an interesting way to start, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Hi, I wouldn't go so far as to say that it couldn't possibly pass the way it is.
Well, maybe.
But please give me an opportunity to tell you a bit about House Bill 2391. With regard to what we've heard here today, you get a sense of the passion that there is around this bill. And with the size of the crowd in this room, we know that so many people care. I do encourage my fellow members to read the comprehensive plan. It's an easy read, and it really tells you this whole picture pretty well. But I think what I want to focus on just for a moment is that family meltdown when suddenly there's a crisis. It was mentioned today. And I can tell you that almost every conversation I have, sooner or later, if this subject comes up, then someone will decide to tell me about, oh, yeah, my sister-in-law. And it's hitting each and every one of us, even those of us who are approaching the upper end of the age spectrum. There's also the family issues going on. And we do need some sort of help for everyone. This is not a division between the Medicaid population and the other population. And we've heard some conversation about the impacts of what it costs in private pay world when Medicaid rates aren't adequate. So we're all in this together, and we need to figure out what it is that we're trying to do in order to provide for a continuum of care. And I try to make sure that I mention that continuum of care, because this isn't you find yourself in this position one day and that's where you're going to stay for the rest of your natural life, because care needs increase. They ebb and flow. And it's not a personal failure if an individual can't stay in their own home for their entire natural life. In-home care will extend that time, and many people can, but then sometimes you need other levels of care, and we need to keep that all together. So when we look at the demographics, by the way, I like the demographics because I like to see that upper age group growing. That's good for me personally. But we have to understand how we're going to do it, and I just want you to keep cost avoidance in your mind. That's the watchword here, is we're trying to avoid greater costs by making good, rational decisions. It was not an easy decision for me to come to what are we going to put in a bill this session when I knew that there were the $120 to $140 million worth of suggestions. So I tried to focus down on what it was that maybe we could do to sort of stem the tide and to make rational, good decisions about what we're doing as we move forward. And that's the genesis of House Bill 2391, which deals a little bit telling you about the demographics of the population of people 65 years or older will double by the year 2030, and that we're going to be severely challenged to adequately meet the long-term care needs. And then it focuses specifically on an aging and disability resource center program to move this forward. I call that sort of an information and referral, and Mr. Taves went through a variety of ways that we can do that, encompassing it in our existing area agency on aging. The primary goal is to have a human being answer a telephone when somebody has a crisis and somebody's in the hospital, geez, I don't know where to turn next, and that isn't somebody who's going to hang up on you in the first 30 seconds. They're going to take time to talk through your situation and help family members, caregivers, the individual needing care themselves, whomever, think about what the options are. And I liken that to if I were living in some other state, Kentucky, that happens to be a state I know is one of the, on the other end of the 70-30% spectrum. And I had a aging parent in Oregon who suddenly ended up in the hospital. I'm facing, mom's getting out of the hospital, what do I do? And I have no familiarity with the extent of the programs that are available to me in the state. I may make that decision that says, okay, that's it, mom's going to the nursing home. So we need to have people be able to think through the rationality of their choices and how long is our nest egg going to last before it runs out and we'll be needing Medicaid assistance. So that's why this is focused a little bit more on what we sort of refer to the pre-Medicaid population in trying to make good decisions and extend that amount of money that people have available to them through a central information center and good planning and service delivery. It also includes the assistance that would be available to folks for short-term care management, case management, education, some in-home services and things like that. I want to emphasize what the chair mentioned, that this isn't in its final format, because frankly, as I read through the draft, I immediately saw several wording changes that I personally would like to see, but I thought it was silly to start an amendment process for three or four words here and three or four words there until we had a chance to collectively talk about it and see what other adjustments. But in a nutshell, the bill is a will require $30 million. Everybody take a deep breath. I understand the challenges that we're facing. I have been having intense conversations with Revenue and Ways and Means about a source of that funding, and there's no sense in opening that can of worms right now, but we are looking at ways to fund that. Would provide $3.9 million for the Central Information Center, $11.8 million to expand the staffing in the local assistance centers, $10.5 million to expand the opportunities for Oregon Project Independence to provide service. This, I think that it's a program that's very important and needs to be adequately funded, but I'm trying to keep it within the bigger context because it isn't the only thing that we do for seniors and people with disabilities in this state. Also has a little in it to expand the family family caregiver support and to establish some programs for chronic disease management. And frankly, as an individual who did a lot of family caregiving with a pretty good knowledge base going in, and my family members ran the gamut from those who really could afford to buy whatever it was they wanted. In that particular case, a couple, because of geriatric psychiatric problems, my aunt ended up in a nursing home and my uncle in a very expensive assisted living facility that was very close by. So you can imagine what they were expending privately on a month-to-month basis. Across the spectrum to my family that are just kind of hanging on and hoping the nest egg lasted, and a mother-in-law who had been receiving Medicaid and SSI for a long time, so found another method of supporting her. So I understand and I empathize with the individual who's ready to step in, and I admire them for the willingness to take care of family members, but just a little source of information is really helpful when you find yourself in that position. So basically that's the thought process behind this bill, and the reason it was laid out in the and it's open for discussion, I'm open to making some adjustments and changes as we go along the way, keeping in mind that we have to be practical about what funding is or, more importantly, is not there. And also having a parallel conversation about maintaining the existing level of services that we heard about today in all of the systems across the board and the devastating impact of not finding a way within our budgeting conversation to maintain those programs is going to be very costly for us in the long run. So it's not an either-or conversation. It's a simultaneous conversation. But that, Madam Chair, is the reason that I'm submitting House Bill 2391 to you today.
Thank you very much, Representative Cowan. Colleagues, we have nine people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone here who needs to leave right at 10, or is there?
Yes, Madam Chair, we have caucus at 10.
Okay, all right. Then we will be through at 10. So if you will help me, those of you, I'm going to call up Darvell Lloyd, Lenore Bijan, is it? Leroy Patton, if you could come up quickly and sit here, and because these, please come up immediately. Thank you. And I'm sorry, I'm only going to be able to give you 2 minutes each, and after your 1 minute is over, I'll be, yes.
Madam Chair, my name is Darvell Lloyd, and I choose not.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, Augusta Hayter?
That's a good point.
So, great. Perfect. Okay, so I'm sorry that we can't give you as much time as we would love to give you, but you can see our problem here. All right, go ahead, sir.
We'll think through that.
Madam Chair, is this on?
Yes, sir, it is.
New experience for me.
Well, good, welcome.
My name.
Give us your name, yes.
My name. My name is Leroy Patton, and I'm an Elders in Action Commissioner. Elders in Action is a 31-member citizen advisory group. I am also the chair of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, which is a statewide discrimination organization for the state of Oregon funded by HUD. We only deal with discrimination cases. My concern is both on the civil rights level of this state approach, which has a lot to do with leaving people out or not providing what they need. If the bill goes through, where do the people go who don't have anywhere to go? Everybody doesn't have a family, somebody to take care of them, or a home to go to. That puts them either in the street or I don't know where that puts them, which makes it a civil rights concern in my sense of discrimination. We have a lot of problems with people who, in their education, they really don't know what's available. And many times there are single people who the people they associate with don't have the information or are not competent in what's going on, and they're left out. So my concern is whether this bill passes or not, where it leaves these people who don't have a backup, who don't have a family, who don't have an educated person to help direct them. They're in the street, just like our homeless. And Madam Chair, that's my
concern. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for bringing that to our attention. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Lenore Bion. I'm an Elders in Action Commissioner. I'm also a senior, a low-income senior who I represent. I am 77 years old. I live on $800 a month Social Security. I was a caregiver for 20 years, and like so many other women, am in this position. I am also a person who is very, very enthusiastic about the idea of healthy aging. And I teach yoga, and I teach Tai Chi, and I will be starting a free class, I do all this for free, to caregivers, stress relief and relaxation. And I certainly applaud House Bill 2391 and Representative Cowan's very compassionate pragmatism in this particular, in regard to this issue. I love the idea of emphasizing prevention, and specifically in simple ways. I bemoan the fact that children and seniors have been pitted against each other in so many political moves in the past 5 years when I've been advocating and have been in touch with all this. I think that it's short-sighted in a way because children are going to be paying the price, as House Bill 2391 sort of suggests, for our penny-wise, dollar-foolish behavior now. Children are ultimately going to be having to bear the brunt of this. With an aging population that is going to double very soon, this we have to come to grips with this, and we have to do it in a compassionate way. I think one answer is to make people less passive about their aging process. I don't think that it is an automatic continuum how one ages. But I also think that it's necessary to begin to take responsibility for what this society has done to establish a paradigm of aging that has to be paid for and is horribly expensive. And we can't just leave people in the streets. We've got to take responsibility for what we have done as a society at the same time that we're working to change that paradigm of aging. That essentially is what I think about this. And I thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. Thanks for your interest in this issue.
Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Augusta Hyder, and I am Commissioner and Vice Chair of Elders in Action. We're advisory group to the Multnomah County Aging and Disabilities and Multnomah County itself and the City of Portland. I live in a senior living facility. There's 172 units there. Approximately 60% of the people living there are seniors, low-income seniors, whose income is below $800 a month. Majority of them are already either getting assistance through the Medicaid program or another program, but they are living way below what I would call poverty. I moved into that building because I have a sister there that needed assistance, and she couldn't traverse the system herself. And I ended up as an advocate because I found even when you have the knowledge, it's hard to traverse it. And I think I really applaud Representative Cowan's bill, and I think it starts someplace. But I'm not sure that we're starting enough. There are people in my building when I go in to help them that won't turn the lights on, that won't turn the heat on because it costs money to do that. Some have just, with this last coal freeze we've had, their electric bill is in the $60, $70, and $80. And their rent is, the lowest rent is $5.25. So you can see where that leaves them as far as buying meds, even if they have a copay. If they're on Oregon Health Plan, there are some limitations. If they have another insurance, they may have already hit the donut. And even though it's the first of the year, they've spent down everything they had to pay for that. So my concern is that prevention to keep seniors from falling through the cracks, to keep seniors from we've had them waste away. I found three people, sorry to say, dead in their apartment because nobody knew. Their case managers couldn't get to them because of their caseload. Some of the tenants, I've seen the case managers, their workers come in, and the workers said they haven't had a case manager in over a month. I know that's probably a normal thing with their caseloads, but when you have a frail person that will not answer the door or cannot answer the door, you know, it's imperative that they have a worker or someone that can get to them or be aware of them. In our building, we call it our neighborhood. We look out for each other. We even have three meals a month that we provide out of our own pockets or through donations. We don't have a problem begging the grocery stores or begging the bakeries or even this summer at the end of the season begging the farmers markets for what they had left over at the end of the day, and then we would bag it up and donate it to the seniors. We have a small pantry, but after this snowstorm, the shelves are bare. So I'm just asking that you open your eyes, your mind, and pass that bill. And I thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much for coming today and for your testimony. So now we have Mary Shortall, David, is it Bond, and Dan Bruland?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
While they're coming up, the fact that this is not enough is something that I think everyone in this room would agree with.
Yes.
We were looking for starting points. So, but I really appreciate the individual stories that we can hear from the folks that are joining us today.
Thank you. And again, you heard 2 minutes.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Shortall. I'm the Division Director for Multnomah County Aging and Disability Services. We're the Area Agency on Aging and Disabilities in Multnomah County and a member agency of O4AD. I, too, am here in support of House Bill 2391, and I want to speak to two parts of it, but the first part is about the need to be investing in services that help people stay more independent and to delay their movement into nursing facility care. I think over the last several years, we've seen a disinvestment in some of our services, especially in the community-based care services. And we've also started to see some uptick in the nursing facility population, although, as James Taves described, we're really working on that. But I think especially as the population ages and as we've seen this disinvestment, there's a need to do more to try to control the costs of nursing home care and keeping people out of the more expensive services. I just want to point out, and I have this in my testimony, but the Lewin Group, National Research Group, has looked at ways across the country, best practices, to control costs. And one of the things that they've identified is that single points of entry, or what is in Representative Collins' bill called Aging and Disability Resource Centers, is a way to do that. And the operations for these are cost-effective, or pay for themselves, I should say, if they simply divert 1 to 1.5% of the people who would be nursing home eligible out of the expensive Medicaid nursing homes settings. And I can't stress enough the fact that getting timely and good information is so important. I was just talking to a case manager yesterday who had a case situation that I think describes it all. She's working with a client who's now in a nursing home, and she has only one family member who is the granddaughter. And the granddaughter, in meaning to do well, when she talked to the medical team, learned that her grandmother's stroke was so serious that she thought she would never get out of a nursing home. She now, several months later, is able to leave the nursing home, but the house is not there. The granddaughter sold all of it because she had power of attorney. And so the situation is now becoming very hard to get her into a lower cost setting. So we're looking at a setting that's going to cost about $5,000 a month on Medicaid, where she could have probably been in a setting that cost about $800 a month. So I think that describes why this timely and good information is needed. The other thing I was going to talk about, but I'm out of time, is Oregon Project Independence. And we'll just say that we really need that investment in that as well. And I have some examples in my testimony of clients that are being served through Oregon Project Independence and what it does to delay nursing home costs. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Don Brulin. I'm Director of Senior and Disability Services, Rogue Valley Council of Governments, the designated area agency on aging for Jackson and Josephine counties, and a member of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging. I've served in this capacity for over 30 years. During that time, I've been convinced that as good as our system is, if Oregon is to meet the growing needs for long-term care services effectively and efficiently, we will need to modify that system. I believe
I'm going to suggest that you not read your materials since we've got it here. You just tell us what you want us to know.
We need to implement this program because it makes a real difference. And in particular, I want to talk about the chronic disease self-management because that's what I'm familiar with because of a demonstration project. Studies in on the Living Well chronic disease self-management program, which we implemented in our district, have shown a decrease of hospital stays of a half day per patient over a two-year time period. In addition, there is a decrease in emergency room use of 2.5 visits per patient for over a two-year period. Some studies have shown this decrease also in physician visits. Medium cost for one day of hospitalization is approximately $5,000. Because of the heavy use of trained volunteers, the average cost per participant in our area for the last years was less than $185. The potential overall cost savings is significant. One important aspect of these programs that I want to emphasize, and which I believe is embodied throughout House Bill
2391 is the calling for a forging of a new partnership between the state and its citizens. That partnership emphasizes that individuals and their families have a responsibility for their health, and the state is willing to be a partner in helping provide the information and resources that will enable them to take better control of their lives. It is this partnership that we will need if we are to create a healthier and more prosperous Oregon. Oregon cannot afford to postpone implementing the changes embodied in House Bill 2391.
Thank you so much. Thanks you for coming all this way, also from Josephine County. We appreciate
Madam
it.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
He's a good man.
I can tell that. I can tell that.
Check it
out. Yeah.
Trusted.
Good.
Trusted agent.
I do. And, you know, I asked people before how many people came more than 55 miles, and you didn't put up your hand, or I would have put you at the top of the list. Yeah. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Scott Bond, and I'm the current chair of O4AD. I'm also the director of Senior and Disability Services, serving Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. And you've heard throughout this morning the issues related to the demographics for the state of Oregon. You've heard that the basic system integrity is in question because of the lack of investment over the last few years. You've heard that we need to create ways that will give us a chance to stabilize our system, to continue to do the high quality work that we do here in Oregon, and that we also, through House Bill 2391, have an opportunity to look at some parts of the system that we really haven't focused on very well in our history in serving seniors and people with disabilities. We think that the bill is a good one, is a good start. It's a way for us to begin this conversation. We're very grateful to Representative Cowan and Senator Morissette for the work that they've done on this. We're very grateful to all of the work that has been done through the partnerships and the campaign to help put forward the ideas and to help put forward the needs that Oregonians face. We think that this is a good first step. We think that investing even a small number of dollars, even in these very difficult times, will be a wise choice. We have to look forward. We can't look backwards and talk about the things that we've lost. We have to look at the current time, the present, and the difficult situations that we face. But we also have to look forward. And I think it's all of our responsibilities to look in a way that we can do something that will help us build even just a little bit of something, a small beachhead in what's going to be facing Oregon over the next 15 to 20 years, and give us a chance to do some of the things that Mary and Don talked about in terms of serving people in a different way, cost-effective way, and give us the tools to be able to meet even just a small part of the need, even in this difficult economic time.
Great. Thank you all so much. I want to encourage people in the audience, too, if your representative is up here, make sure you make personal appointments to talk with these people and tell them how important these issues are for you and your community. Thank you so much. And now I think our last two people are Maria, is it Chamberlain?
Yes.
And Maria Mukosi-Jones. Am I? Oh, we were waiting to hear from you.
You might ask for
Madam Chair.
Yes.
As we close, yes. Just have a couple comments.
Sure. Yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee members, I want to thank you for this opportunity to extend my enthusiastic support for House Bill 2391. Thank you. My name is Maya Chamberlain. I'm the program director of the Friendly House Senior Program in Northwest Portland. We serve independent living seniors in Northwest, Linton, and Sobeys Island through case management and in-home services provided by OPI. Our clients include Val, who passed away peacefully in the home that she was born in 101 years before. So it's that kind of choice that I've heard brought up. I'm actually here today to represent two OPI clients we serve who were unable to be here given their complicated medical conditions and the early hour of this hearing. The first is Helen Ruth Stevens from Northwest Portland, and she wanted to say to you how much. First, she wanted to express her gratitude to Representative Cowan for understanding the bill's urgency for so many of us whose lives would be devastated by the loss of OPI funding. Instead of my testimony and proprieties, I have my story to offer. I'm a 70-year-old retired college professor who fully intended to be responsible for herself, both financially and physically, in the last years of her life. Life did not work out that way. Instead, after some bad luck and poor financial decisions, I'm living in public housing with an income which ClearPoint Financial Solutions describes as negative $215 per month. I'm also living with COPD, asthma,
which is
chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Thank you.
Asthma, severe chronic depression, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and post-polio fatigue, to list a few of my physical disabilities. Living on a negative income would be impossible without the assistance and guidance of my case manager, Megan Brodell. She's assisted me in connecting with LEAP energy emergency funds when I was several hundred dollars arrears in my electric bill. She also connected me with the weatherization people who will be coming next week to help me lower my electric bill. She's provided me with a bus pass to make it possible to get to my daily pulmonary rehab workouts. When summer's heat put intolerable stress on my breathing, she provided me with an air conditioner. Extreme physical exhaustion makes it impossible for me to maintain my household without assistance. OPI funding has provided weekly housekeeping visits for a few hours, which without, I could see myself becoming evicted for unwholesome premises. I don't exaggerate to say OPI funding and the support and services of my case manager, Megan, have saved my life. She's also helped me to understand that it's a life worth saving. It would be a dreadful cruelty to thousands like me not to pass House Bill 2391. Our lives literally depend on it. Sincerely yours, Helen Ruth Stevens.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Do I have time for a second one? No.
Okay. I thought I'd try.
But we will read it.
All right. We will certainly read it. Thank you so much. And thank you all here who have come today to discuss with us this very, very important issue. Representative Cowan, I know some people have to go, but I
know.
Go ahead.
I just want to close that I am very gratified by the spontaneous testimony that we've heard here today that was uninvited. I didn't contact any of these people. That's very fulfilling to see how many people care about this issue. And I think what it does is it tells us how many good examples there are of programs that are trying to do the right thing. And we're just trying to bring it together so that we can get that word out. There is through the Real Choices Systems Change Grant, which I believe was federal, there is a pilot project functioning in Lane County called Person-Centered Hospital Discharge. So as we move through, we can get some folks who are running an ADRC type of program as a pilot that may be able to give us a little better picture of just how that sort of thing
works.
And
maybe we could have a presentation later on that.
Right. I knew there wouldn't be time today, right. So we didn't schedule that.
Right.
So thank you very much.
And this is an issue that we will be spending a lot of time on this session, so stay involved with us. Especially let your legislators know that you feel strongly about this. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on